One of the things that always would happen, too, is my dad would torture my mom by saying, Liz, just pull out the accordion and play a song. And at the most awkward, inopportune moments, and she's like, I don't want to pull out the thing now. We're eating dinner or what. Just pull it out and play them a song. They love that stuff. And just, you know, and so we thought to make it authentic, we thought, Mom, you have to play the accordion, even if it's awkward and weird. So that's what that was. And also what some of this is, too, I mean, one of the things, this was the perfect country for my parents to move to also, because my dad, he loves to interrogate people, not because he's trying to torture them, but because he's just interested in people. And here you're allowed to do that. You're just, you know, in the West, especially in America, you have to smile and you have to kind of roundabout, you know, you're not allowed to ask someone who they voted for, how much money do you make and how much. Here, those are like the first questions you ask someone. It's like totally legitimate, you know, to ask somebody how much money do you make and who did you vote for, and as an opening question, like you don't even have to know their name yet. And really it's because they're, because, you know, my dad is just interested. And that happened last night. We had a guest over, and poor thing, from London. And, you know, I don't, is she here, Jesse? Okay. And, you know, and we just had to tell her, don't be afraid. He's just really, he likes you. And the other thing is, I hope you don't feel like this is some kind of hagiographic, trying to put them on a pedestal.
They are on a pedestal.
They are kind of on a pedestal right now, yes. Hagiographic is like turning someone into a saint.
They arrived a long time ago.
Yeah. It's not about that. Like, we can get into some nitty-gritty now, too, about frustrations and all kinds of things that went wrong along the way. But this is about God working through our weaknesses and our struggles and creating beauty through ashes and just doing amazing things despite ourselves.
And we also kind of wanted it to, it's about transparency, right? We all go through things, and usually we don't tell everybody what we're going through, but Chuck and Liz's life has been through all kinds of ups and downs and challenges, and they've been very open about it, and it's helped a lot of us along the way. And so if we can be more like that as well. You know, another idea with this talk was kind of like a hard talk, where you kind of talk about things and tell us really what you're feeling, and because I think God works in, like Danny just said, in our weaknesses and the things that cause us problems. That's where God really shows up. So we wanted, if we go to the first slide there, this is Chuck and Liz in their heyday. Was this right after you're married? Early 70s?
Yes.
This is for you, by the way.
We were married in January 1st, 1969, and came to Israel that February, March.
Sinai, right?
We went straight to Sinai with a group of friends, and happened to be literally right after, a few years after the Six-Day War. And on this track where we are is the Mitle Pass. It was the historic bombing of all the Egyptian tanks that were coming into Israel at the Six-Day War. Israel had a genius of a plan to fly over all the way to one end of Mitle Pass, bomb it, so that there was no other road. It was just one long road. And if you left the road, you got stuck in the sand. So we literally saw the tanks stuck in the sand on the sides where our Egyptian army was trying to get away. And there were still soldiers, uniforms with the bones inside still. No one had time to clean it up yet. it was a very sobering, sobering sight. It was very, brought the Six-Day War to a very clear picture for me on that trip. That was the 67 war, but we came made the trip on Mitle Pass in 69.
So we want to go to the next. We want to play two introductions, one of Chuck and the next one of Liz. They're about a minute each, and then we'll start from there, just to give people an overview who don't know Chuck and Liz's lives.
Chuck Kopp, Reverend Pastor Chuck Kopp, came first to Israel in 1959 as an 11-year-old with his sister and parents for a six-month ministry trip. Chuck returned to Israel in 1966 at the age of 18 to run a book and Bible shop later known as Cornerstone. He met his wife Liz on tour here in 1968, and they have lived here ever since. They began attending the congregation here in 1970 after meeting Bob and Margaret Lindsay. In the mid-1970s, Chuck became an elder in the congregation. In 1992, Chuck became pastor of the congregation and has since become the longest-serving pastor in the history of this property. Chuck has served multiple times as chairman of the United Christian Council in Israel, today known as the Evangelical Alliance of Israel, and is senior advocate of evangelical matters and visas in the Israeli Religious Affairs Office. He is probably the best known and the most important Protestant person, and so sometimes is known as I have called him, the Pope of the Protestants. In the best of ways, if there's a problem, Chuck can probably fix it on all sorts of levels, because he's that kind of guy. And so we want to welcome Pastor Chuck Kopp to give this presentation.
This is from 4 years ago, by the way.
So glad to be here.
Okay. And then the next one is Liz.
Liz is going to be sharing with us about the Music Man. Liz Kopp first came to Israel at the age of 18. At the age of 18 on a Holy Land tour just after the Six-Day War of 1967. On that tour, she met her future husband, Chuck Kopp, who encouraged her to return and study Hebrew. I wonder if it was just that. She and Chuck soon married and first started attending services at Baptist House in 1970. Soon, Liz began playing piano during the Baptist House worship services, and over four decades later, she continues to lead worship in Northeast.
She's still 18.
I'll pay you later.
Besides music, Liz is a comforter of the hurting and a benefactor of the poor. Her generosity is legendary, her hospitality is lavish, and her home is open to all. The Kopp House has been affectionately known throughout the years as a bus station, a place to find direction, help, and community. Many have entered through their doors, empty or hungry. All have left full. Liz Kopp.
Sounds like an obituary, but I'll take it. Thank you for those kind words. I'll try to live up to them.
So the next slide, Chuck and Liz, check out that picture there. You're just married. This is 1969. Okay. You just had your 50th anniversary this last year. What are you thinking right now in this picture? Grab your microphone.
I'm a bit embarrassed.
He said he's a bit embarrassed. Are you asking him what he's thinking in that picture there, or what is he thinking sitting in this chair?
I don't
right
know.
Now?
Just something.
What are you thinking there, Chuck?
you, those were some days.
He didn't know what he was in for.
So you get married in Chicago.
We did.
And it's New Year's Day or New Year's Eve?
Night.
It's the 31st?
January 1st.
Okay.
After the New Year's party, everybody came back to our wedding.
Her father was a pastor, and he married us.
Right.
We just flew in for the wedding. They did it all.
And then you at some point, you got a car, right, after the wedding?
With our honeymoon money, wedding money, we flew to France and bought a little Peugeot.
Okay, just hold it there. You bought a Peugeot and you drove it through Europe, right?
We drove through Europe, wanted to meet my family in Czechoslovakia that I hadn't met yet.
Okay, and you're going back to Israel to live and to have a family and to do...
We already had tickets for the ferry in Turkey.
Yeah.
We had a deadline.
Okay, next slide. So what's this picture make you think of? That's a Peugeot.
That's the brand new Peugeot.
I had been driving most of the day, and I finally wanted Liz to turn over the wheel to Liz, and we had been, and so I could relax and perhaps fall asleep, because we were going to drive right on through to Turkey to catch a ship that was going to Israel, and it was. And then I heard Liz cry out, and I kind of stiffened up and raised from the seat, reclined, and I forget what she said, but anyway, she had missed the turn on the bridge, and it went flying off into the wadi, and.
You're in Greece at this point, right?
Yeah, we just drove out of Salonika. We were on to the next town called Kavela. And it was my turn to drive. I was excited. We had just met all our relatives. The car was full of crystal from Slovakia that they had given us as wedding presents. And
it went all over your body.
Yeah. and we were high in the mountains, and the roads were really tiny back then. Now you have big highways. Back then we had small roads, and thousands of feet drops is what I saw in the daylight. But as I was driving, all of a sudden what I yelled out was, I missed the bridge. Suddenly in the dark, and there's no lights, we're driving on a lonely road with no lights at all in the pitch dark. And all of a sudden there's a turn and a bridge. I didn't have time to stop. I didn't have time to turn. I just went straight off.
How many feet?
I thought it was going to be thousands, so I had totally saw my life go before me like a video. I knew we were dying. And I thought, what a way to die. I'm only 19. Haven't even lived yet. And it turned out to be only about a flight of about 120 feet. And we hit solid rock, which...
Obviously.
Incidentally busted the motor and turned the car upside down, and we skid down to the rest of the ravine. And the ravine was dry, which was amazing, because it was January. It could have been filled with water. It was dry. And at that moment, as I was going off the bridge, my life going before me, I'm thinking, I just hope God outweighs the good. I mean, I just hope the good of my life outweighs the bad, because otherwise I'm going straight to hell. And when I woke up alive, albeit halfway in the car and half out, and pretty mangled, I had a big hole in my head, took 50 stitches to shut, and blood pouring everywhere, my leg upside down, it was broken. I was absolutely immersed with the unconditional love of God, just enveloped, overwhelmed, saturated. I was so, I couldn't believe it. I thought, oh, He had mercy on me. He didn't make me face judgment right now and let me live to figure it out, figure out who He is and what He wants from my life.
What was you and Chuck's background, your families? What were you coming from, and how did you get to this point?
Well, I was seventh generation in the ministry. That's six more generations before me. And
seven generations of your ancestors, grandfather, great-grandfather, father, were all ministers, you were the seventh.
And I came from a background of Pentecostal church, Foursquare, I remember my grandmother telling us how she had moved from Missouri to Kansas in a covered wagon, and that was the days of the old pioneers, and also she had used to tell us about she was at the age of confirmation in the United Brethren Church, and the bishop was coming and visiting all the churches in his area, and she remembers telling the church that his sons were making experiments flying, and he turned out to be the father of
the Wright brothers,
Orville and Wilbur Wright, and they were of course the fathers of flight, and so the church prayed for him, for them, that he would be safe during those experiments. But anyway, so that's the background I come from.
So you grew up going to church all the time?
Right.
Every time the door was open?
Right.
So this is an appropriate place for you to be right now.
Yeah. When I was 5 years old, I was forced to sing a song. You want to?
The same one. One of the similar songs I was told to sing.
Can y'all do it? You could do a duet, maybe? The song from when you were 5 years old?
We can say the words. I have no voice.
This is a song that my mom sang just the other day, and I was just shocked at the lyrics, because we were talking about what we teach our kids, and she said, well, this is a song that we used to sing. And
turns out Chuck sang the same song in front of his church when he was five. I sang in front of our church in Oregon when I was five.
My mommy told me something a little boy should know. It's all about the devil, and I learned to hate him so.
She
says he causes trouble when he enters
in the room. He'll never leave you if your heart is filled with gloom.
So let the sun shine in, face it with a grin.
Did you catch that?
Yeah, the first line.
Just say the first line.
My mommy told me something every little girl should know. It's all about the devil, and I learned to hate him so.
And then he comes into the room, and
she
what?
She said he causes trouble if you let him in the room, and he'll never, ever leave you if your heart is filled with gloom. So let the sun shine in. Face it with a grin. Smilers never lose, and frowners never win.
Terrifying. That's just... Wow.
So
it was another era, basically. Nothing like that song to give you a window into another era. Wow.
So, Liz, you shared here about a year ago, I think, about your testimony of what you came from, but maybe you could just give a 5-minute synopsis of your family.
Yeah, so the reason I knew I wasn't ready for heaven when we went off that cliff, I was already planning in my mind, I know how we're going to... This marriage is going to work. Chuck is going to be the missionary. And I am going to join a rock band. Everything's going to be just fine. And that was the frame of mind I was in. And why? I grew up in a church. My parents were political escapees from Czechoslovakia. I had a dramatic experience of coming to the faith in the refugee camp in Germany where I was born, in Ludwigsburg. And when I was 6 months old, they were given a care package from a church, a Baptist church in Chicago, that we happened to live one block away from when we ended up in Chicago. And I used to go to that church during the catechism hour from school. And
that they get sent a care package with testimonies of people whose lives were changed. And my father read that, and he figured that that's what they need. They really need that because they weren't getting along in the prison camp either. And they had almost gotten divorced before they escaped. So
he was a serial adulterer, cheating on her.
And cheating on her in the camp.
And they had come out of atheism, communism, or socialism?
No, he was fighting communism.
Yeah, that's right, fighting.
He was a... in fact, I just learned that he was also fighting the Nazis when they came in. He was one of the
partisans
in the woods. But anyway, they became believers, both of them, turned their life around, ended up coming to America, and then after being involved in a very strict church in Oregon, they decided to leave and go to Chicago and start their own church. And the tragedy is that they became very cultish. And I think I'm so often reminded of that scripture that you lose your first love and you end up hanging on to one truth and you become stagnant in that one truth because you've lost your first love and you're not growing, you're not learning new things about God day by day, minute by minute sometimes. And so the us kids rebelled and got very angry and bitter against God and religion in general because of the tight reins, all the legalism and everything that goes with legalism and the dark side of institutionalized Christianity. So I was only happy to get away from it and come here to the land of religion.
So you end up in a ditch with everything, your body smashed. And then you somehow hobble your way to Israel, right?
Yeah.
Couple months?
Or? I thought for sure I had killed Chuck because I woke up and I thought, he's dead. And I'm laying here in the gutter. It's after midnight. There's no car on the road. Oh, this is it. And I screamed. I said, Chuck, where are you? And he had been crushed like an accordion. That's his side of the car. And because he was laying down that length of it. And I heard him say, I'm crawling out the back window. did something to his voice box, I guess. And he spoke like that for a few days until it cleared up.
Did he crawl up the side of the...
He crawled up. He didn't have anything broken because he was sound asleep. So he crawled up the side of the mountain, and fortunately, a pickup truck was driving by and stopped and took us to the hospital.
And that was very painful for you.
I have delivered 7 children. And the delivery of 7 children put together does not equal a broken bone near the top of the femur that doesn't have a splint on it, and you're just thrown over a guy's shoulder to get up to the car. It's unbelievable pain.
So you end up in Israel. Let's say it's around 1970. You've been here. You've come back because Chuck's father, grandfather, have opened up a Bible shop or a bookshop, Zion, Christian Zion. Bookshop, and Chuck's all about giving out the word and distributing it, and we'll talk about more about that later. But how did you come here to this property?
Well, we knew Bob Lindsay, who was very well known in this part of the world and abroad for his scholarship and for his great insight into the scripture and how Oliver worked. How we're running here in the front row, in the second row, worked with him on many projects with Professor David Flusser from the university. And a lot of people didn't understand the dynamic of a Christian pastor working with a Jewish rabbi and scholar.
Chuck, let me just interrupt. This is Bob Lindsay, who Chuck is talking about, who was the pastor here when Chuck and Liz came in 1970.
And he nevertheless found it very fulfilling because he had insights from the ancient Hebrew text, and he understood a lot of difficult passages in the New Testament. With their background and he had insight because of the they studied the how what would you say the old text.
Read the Greek New Testament and ask what did Jesus say in Hebrew.
Yeah, did you get that? He said the old Greek text actually concealed a Hebrew underpinning, a Hebrew story, and we haven't yet discovered the Hebrew text that we know is there. But when you read the Greek New Testament, it's clear that it's not straightforward Greek. What it has, it preserves the style and the context is all Jewish and Israeli Jewish.
Chuck, I remember, I believe you were coming here first, and then, because Liz wanted to be in a rock and roll band, and she had to practice on Shabbats, maybe, for the band. But, Liz, what's that story about Bob asking you to do worship and Margaret, somebody singing something about high heels?
You would think that after what I experienced, the love of God ministering to me in the gutter there, you would think that would have been enough to turn my life around, but it wasn't, unfortunately. It just added to the questions. I knew I wasn't free to do whatever I wanted at that point. There were consequences, but it threw me into a deep depression because I didn't have any answers. And I couldn't read the Bible because I only heard the very legalistic interpretations of what I grew up with. So I couldn't read the Bible. So I read books. I read philosophers. And the depression got worse. The deeper I went into philosophy, the deeper the depression got. And I tried going to church. When we first came here, we attended the Garden Tomb because we loved the people at the Garden Tomb and the Vanderhovens, and they were so welcoming and opening and always had us for tea and biscuits after the service. And then when we started having children, Dahlia and Shrona were starting to come along. That was about the time I wanted to find a church that had a program for children. But just before that, we made another trip to Sinai with our two daughters. And I was at the lowest point in my life. Low, so low, you know you can't commit suicide because you're going to face God. So there's no way out. You got to live this life with no answers. And I had just finished reading Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis. And I thought, this is a Christianity I could believe in. It has answers. It has logic. And it fed my soul. But I was still not free. And so that night, just before we were going to climb Mount Sinai before sunrise, the windshield froze over. It was that's how cold it was. I couldn't sleep. And I was desperate for an answer. And I just cried out to God. I've got to know. I can't live a religious life. That's not me. I just ran away from it. But I felt God saying to me very clearly, the same love that I felt in that gutter. I felt him say to me, I don't want you for that. I want you for myself. And again, I was set free from all that. The bondage that I thought I had to be put under, I didn't have to be put under it. I was free to find out who God is and why he loves me and why he let me live. And then Bob Lindsay came to our house for dinner one night, and he says, you know, Liz, we need a pianist. We don't have a pianist. We need somebody to come play the piano. And but then I'm about ready to go back to church. And who could say no to Bob? Nobody. So I came, and I said, but I was still, you know, leery with, you know, this legalism and stuff. And so I came in my shortest miniskirts and halter tops. And I said, if anybody doesn't like the way I'm dressed, I'm out of here. I'll never come back again. To me, that's the most amazing miracle. No one said a word to me the whole time. Not one. In fact, I learned years later that someone had gone to Margaret Lindsay and said, how can you let that girl play the piano dressed like that? And Margaret's answer was, oh, I wish I could do that too.
So, can we play that next clip here? Going along with Bob was a musician. He actually played piano and led worship as well. He played the trumpet and maybe even more. The next one, we play that.
Bob was available. And
Sorry, I should introduce it. Chuck is talking about Bob Lindsay. So maybe we could just rewind that one. He's talking about Bob here.
Bob was available. And we didn't want to wear that out, but sometimes she'd get on the back of my scooter, and we'd drive to their house and just drop in on them. And of course, in the States now, or most places in Europe, you would never think of doing that. And so that to me was what a real pastor.
And then the next one, go ahead. This is Bob. Yeah, there's two visitors with Bob here.
My last cornet, I think I gave to one of the orphans at the orphan's home, and he sold it. I remember to make a little money on the side. And an earlier one I lost because somebody stole it. So I've had various cornets and gone through them.
Chuck's on the trombone.
It's been years actually since I really played a cornet until a couple of years ago. I got this little beat up Czechoslovakian horn in the Cyprus, and I've been playing on it for a while.
There's Chuck. Chuck can play a mean trombone. And there's Milana.
He's a very noisy person, and because I'm rather quiet and sometimes like quiet, occasionally I have really wished for a little more silence.
It's Bob's wife. So when we talk about like the kitchen table here and we talk about fellowship, this is another aspect of the Kopp family. It was music, where you gather to live life together. And in more modern terms, we talk about jamming. Like Danny, when you were a youth with Yoni, that's kind of how the youth group started, right? Back in the 80s?
Yeah.
Do you want to?
Yeah, definitely. Just and it's like what you're saying. Well, my dad was just saying that in the West, there's this, you're not allowed to just kind of just drop in unannounced anymore. It's the hours and hours and hours of jamming.
Being together.
Yeah. That we would do with Yoni, and I don't know if Yoni felt like telling us no. He just isn't able to say no, I guess. But we would just... I think that's what it just takes sometimes. Like, you're not able to kind of like really press through a problem sometimes in a half hour session sometimes. Sometimes you're talking through something and sometimes it just takes 5 hours, you know? And who has 5 hours to give anybody these days?
Yeah, we're too busy these days.
No way.
Yeah.
I mean, especially like the way our lives are now with kids. We got homework and this and that, and I mean, I think about, you know, my mom and dad had all of us seven kids, but there were just always people around, and they were just available to people when they had issues that just took hours sometimes. And, yeah.
So I think this is an aspect about your family, Chuck and Liz, that at the end of the day, we talk about your house being a bus station. People are coming into your house at all hours of the day. They show up with suitcases. You don't know who they are, but somebody told them to go to you. And this is for the last 40 plus years. And, you know, you're having people die, and you're having to carry them in your van, their bodies decomposing. You have people getting married and people having babies. You have crazy people that end up at your place that you have to commit, right? I was there personally. I almost got committed to the asylum. But fortunately, they said, no, not the guy who looks crazy, but the other guy.
This was a funny. We had this guy who, one of these people who came and said, can I stay for a while, and ended up staying years. He stayed at our house for years. And then
He thought he was a priest.
He thought he was a priest, like, from the Bible. And then he thought that he should live upstairs and not my parents. And then he punched my dad and tried to kick him out. And then it was time for him to be admitted. He got Jerusalem syndrome.
Yeah.
For those of you who are visitors, look it up. It's a real clinically legitimate thing. Look it up. It's on Wikipedia. But so when we took him to the hospital, there's a lady we know who works there. And so we were all standing there, and, you know, how do you do this? And so she said, she's looking at the group of us, and so she said, well, you know, which one is it? And then, you know, we're kind of like, you know, because we're all standing there.
I'm like over there drinking water or something.
Gary's standing there in his, like, flip-flops and his pink Florida, you know.
No, I had a flannel shirt on.
You did?
Totally Nirvana.
I don't know. But he had his long hair and looks like Gary looks. And she's like, is it him? For a split second, I was so tempted. We gave up the other guy.
But... you know, you have these instances going on all the time in your house and your family. And obviously there's consequences when, you know, you've got too much stress all the time. It's not like, you know, it's always a picture-perfect story. But there are funny stories, obviously. And, you know, we've all survived. But what's it like in that type of life, of ministry? How, because, Liz, you've talked about, you know, when orphans start coming into your life, and people who don't have anywhere to go, they don't have husbands, they need help for school, and, you know, what's an insight into?
I'm sure that we neglected our own kids to the detriment of their future, and we were so focused on ministry that we should have given more attention to our own kids. But I'm happy today that our two oldest children are here. Danny, here on my right, and Dahlia on our left. And Dahlia is our first daughter, first child, and Danny is our oldest son. And also Jesse, who's operating his cameras. He's our youngest son, who's a twin, and he is 5 minutes older than his sister, and he reminds her of that all the time. He's five minutes older than her.
And they were born when you were 40? Liz was 40 when she gave birth to her last two children.
Yeah.
We sent out a notice on April 1st, said that we were going to have twins. And I said, in case you think this is a dubious notice, check inside and inside. I had put a picture of the sonogram. Two babies. After five kids, and the youngest was seven at the time, having twins was quite a blast. I loved it, especially because it was a boy and a girl, and I could compare, you know, the... how boys choose boy toys and girls choose girl toys in the room full of all the mixture. It was a fascinating study to see how babies respond to their environment.
I also want to say I'm happy to see our grandchildren. Most of them are back behind the wall of the soundboard. And so it's good to see Evan and Elliot and Milana. And where's Talene? Talene is there somewhere hiding, and we see you. Anyway,
one thing I loved always was the unexpected. I don't like routine. I like the unexpected. I like living life on the edge. And my motto is, if you're not living life on the edge, you're taking up too much room. And God saw to it that I had plenty of excitement. We've been asked to take people into our home that the courts turned over to us because they were under house arrest. We've done that several times. It's always been interesting and very enlightening. The year the twins were born, there was a little girl that had been kidnapped by her father when she was 3, and she was now 7 years old in Chicago. The mother was almost strangled to death, but she survived, and so she hired a lawyer here because the father brought the daughter here. And I found the little girl walking down the street, and she wasn't in school. She was living alone in the apartment with her father, and it was a very unhealthy situation. So the lawyer managed to get the child away from him. She came and lived with us, and it was the same year we were going to go home to our Dahlia and Shrona's graduations from university. And here was this little girl, 7-year-old girl, who hadn't seen her mother for 4 years, and she was going to go back to Chicago with us. But I had twins. They were only about 9 months old then. And the beauty of that, actually, I need to back up a little bit. When I was pregnant with them, I was walking to the car one day, and I said, God, if you want me to do anything in this kingdom for you, you're going to have to bring it to the house, because I'm going to be swamped with diapers and nursing for a couple of years. I'm not going to see daylight. And that's exactly what God did. He brought people to our house, and he brought this little girl. And the beauty of having twins was she knew she couldn't latch on to me as a mother figure as much as she probably would have liked to, because she saw I was really busy with 2 little babies of my own. And she became my little helper instead of becoming dependent on me, which was so, so beautifully divine of God psychologically for her, because by the time we got her on the plane to her mother in Chicago, she totally gravitated to her mother and was so happy to see her and bonded with her mother immediately. So there were incidents like that, and then we got involved with the orphanage in Bethlehem because another friend of mine had tried to adopt 2 Muslim children, and if you're Christian, you're not allowed to adopt here, so she had to return them. I was with her the day we returned them. They were over a year old and already calling her mommy and crying as we had to hand them over to some strange man. And we had to walk out, and they're screaming, mommy, mommy, mommy. It broke my heart. But that friend had to leave the country, and I became the one here in the country who became the auntie. And
How old is he now?
He's now in his 30s, and the father himself with 2 beautiful children. And so we've lived with these kids. We've been to their weddings. We've been to their births of their children, their birthday parties, and he's just one of them. In fact, just Thursday, I took them all to the zoo because they needed to come from the checkpoint, didn't know how to get to the zoo, and so I dropped them off at the zoo. They spent the day, picked them back up, took them to McDonald's for supper, and had a really good time just to be able to get out of Bethlehem a bit.
So let's skip that next one, Justin. We're going to close it here in a little bit.
Chuck.
Skip this one. So maybe just a couple of seconds here, flip through. Chuck's playing his trombone, and Liz, they were their own rock band, as you can tell, and they toured the world. And then they took it to their kids. The next one. Oh, sorry. This is our church that was burned down. The church used to be out here. And Liz is still playing the piano, even in the midst of the ashes. That's a whole nother story. We don't have time for it. Next one. I like this one here with Danny. Danny's got his Flying V guitar. Where'd you get that guitar from, Danny?
Chicago somewhere.
Chicago, yeah. We all got guitars from Chicago. So I think everybody almost plays an instrument in your family, right? There's Julie in the middle, and then David is on the far back wall there. Obviously, Chuck and Liz.
And it's Sharona drawing.
It's Sharona, yeah. So let's go to the next one, Justin. This was their bookshop. It was downtown. Doesn't exist anymore because it got knocked over to build a large building. At that point, it was called the Zion Messianic House. Okay, Chuck, this is what I really want to hit on right here. You love to hand out Bibles. Yeah. Matter of fact, where are the Bibles? There's some right here. He brought in Bibles from his car this morning. And here you are. You're caught in action. You're a teenager probably here, 18 or 19. And is this somewhere? Where is this? Do you remember?
From the Negev.
Negev? Negev. So Bedouin maybe? And then the next picture, is that Morris Cirillo?
Yes.
Is that how you say, yeah? Okay, so you've been a literature guy. That's Chuck there in the middle. And
Shlomo Chizak. Shlomo Chizak.
Yeah, Shlomo Chizak. Okay, yeah, the guy on the left is Shlomo Chizak. He was a bodyguard for Ben-Gurion, the first prime minister of Israel. And next picture, I think, is this happened last month. You were caught again handing out Bibles to some Bible translators and consultants. What, Chuck, what is it about the Bible that...
Well,
yeah, there's Randy and
Margaret. I enjoy giving them these diglot, two-language Bibles, in French and Russian and Hebrew and German and Hebrew and Spanish and Hebrew and English and Hebrew, Russian and Hebrew. And I see how it makes people smile and are thrilled to receive these Bibles. And I thought that the Bible translators, instead of having two books on their desk when they're doing translation work, it all in one book, and they could just look across and look at the translation and see how accurate it was. So that's why I do it. It brings a lot of satisfaction to me.
The next one, is that a Begin? Menachem Begin,
yeah.
Who was prime minister here. Very famous in the Camp David Accords with Egypt. And Chuck, you reluctantly got involved with the politics here in the country in order to help ministers get visas.
Well, I found out pretty early that it's not what you know, but it's who you know that makes things work here. And if you can get to the right person, you generally get some help. But, you know, the underlings are all afraid to make any move or action on them by themselves. There's a chain of command, and the top one has to make all the decisions. So I learned that I needed to go right to the top and to get things done. And that's what I did.
And I mean, we've been blessed. I get a visa through Chuck and Liz, and many people here do as well. And their sacrifice, again, it's like the table, you know, where you come to their table and they're generous and they're there to help you in your time of need or whatever it is. They've always been there to help others, and especially like with visas, it's the same concept.
So, and one question I wanted to just ask, and maybe we'll close with this, but you've had Parkinson's now, and for over 14 years now, and it's been a war, kind of,
yeah.
or more so, even it's a daily battle. And I've just seen how you've been fighting it, and I've seen what's amazing is when you get Parkinson's, you suddenly see what a common disease this is and see how many people struggle with it. And I'm constantly struck with just how people are fighting this war and what a difficult thing with it is. And it's like war in that most people have a hard time talking about it. They have a hard they come back from war and they have PTSD, you know. I mean, in World War II, they called it shell shock. But you had a harder time in the beginning also talking about it. But then at some point you just made a decision that you were going to just face it, face on. And I've just been humbled and amazed with both of yours, because it's a war for both of you, really, almost equally, as a couple. And I just realized that I don't have even a fraction of the bravery and the stamina and the faith that you've exhibited.
Optimism. It amazes me that Chuck remains so optimistic, even through it.
Yeah. And so, in this battle, you talked about your home being a ministry, and you continue to have that ministry because you're restricted to the home. And so in many ways, it's kind of enhanced the home as a place of ministry. I think about Bob, how his leg got blown off. And that
Bob Lindsay was rescuing an orphan here in Jerusalem in 1961. And he crossed over the minefield between Jordan and Israel, which was right next to the old city currently today. And his leg, he stepped on a landmine. It didn't literally blow his leg off, but it severed it in a very bad way, and eventually he had to have it cut off. And so that's what Danny's referencing.
And that handicap sort of...
And so he always walked around with a wooden leg.
He had a wooden leg, yeah. And then that handicap became a feature and almost a strength of his ministry. And it, you know, your Parkinson's and the way that you deal with it is a testimony.
Bob used to take a knife and on the wooden leg, he'd stab himself.
He'd come up to us kids, and we knew trick the first time he'd do it. But whenever
he had his pants on, so you couldn't see the wooden leg.
You couldn't see there was a wooden leg. So anytime a new kid would come up, we used to love this. We'd say, Bob, Uncle Bob, we called him. And we said, show the new kid, you know, the trick you do. And he'd take a knife, and his wife hated it because he'd ruin his pants every time. And he'd take a knife and he'd just go whack, and he'd stab his leg, and the kid would just freak out.
He would ask the kids, "Can you do that?"
Yeah, he'd say, "Can you do that?" So.
He would say, "I bet you can't do this."
Yeah, I bet you can't do this. And they're thinking, you know, just sticking out of his leg.
And sometimes he'd take it off and then pass it around like he's looking for a donation.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about this war that you're in.
Well, just a very short explanation. When I came in first in 1959, we drove across from the West Coast to the East Coast of the United States, and it took several days to do that. And we came to New York and bought a ticket to Israel, and we just left the port in New York on the Manhattan Island, and it was a foggy night, but we had just been on the water cruising eastward when a Greek liner struck our ship right in the middle. And we were down in the dining room with the captain of the ship, and the water started flowing and covering our feet with water. And so the captain immediately said, everyone to the deck and get on life jackets. And so we did that. And the place that the ship grounded itself, we hadn't left the we were in the Hudson River, and we hadn't left the port too long, and we ran aground on the Statue of Liberty Island, of all places, and then we limped back to the port after they stabilized the situation. But what did you ask now?
And when that happened, your bike got stolen, right? That you were bringing
right,
to Israel.
Right, and the stevedores unloaded the Zimline's ship, the Israeli ship. Someone pinched in English and stole an American.
Your bicycle.
My brand new bicycle. Mm-hmm. So I started off the trip on a sour note.
That was your entrance to Israel.
Yeah. And then when I got here in 59, I found out that they didn't have ice cream in the winter.
No ice cream in Israel in 1959.
Yeah, and I love ice cream.
Yeah.
So, but there was one, I only remember one signal in the whole city, and that was at the corner of Strauss and Jaffa, and it wasn't long after that they began to multiply these stop and go signals all throughout the city. But I just remember that one signal then, and Jerusalem was kind of like the end of the world. The Israelis from the coast didn't want to come up here, because they considered it dangerous to come up to Jerusalem because we were on a narrow wedge. Yeah.
So, and going back to your bicycle on the ship, that's how you, is that how you deal with your Parkinson's? Is that what you're trying to say?
Well, I deal with it openly, and I talk about it, and I just I trust the Lord to touch my body and heal me. I believe in healing, and I believe that God could make me well. But I've come to the decision that if this takes me to heaven earlier than I might normally go to heaven, I feel like Job, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. And so either way, it's a win-win situation. So I'm praying for healing, but ready to go with the Lord at any time.
Mom, did you want to add something to that?
I'm just grateful that the Parkinson's didn't give him a feeling of depression. I'm just so grateful for that. He's always been optimistic. Even when we went off that cliff, he's like, well, you know.
But I might add, if you have Parkinson's, don't ask your spouse to be your principal caregiver, because it causes great tension.
Yes, you can pray for me that God will give me more patience.
But, Liz is my chauffeur now, and my lifeline. So I can't do without her, and I don't want to do without her either.
I'm amazed at the provision God has given, even with this Parkinson's. The government, the system here, the medical system, provided us with a caregiver to start with 15 hours a week, and wouldn't you know, he happens to be a believer. Mm-hmm. So we're very grateful. He's a wonderful man and a big, big help.
Yeah, those are some crazy odds that the caregiver that was sent to them happens to be a what's being recorded, so on. He was a right fit, perfectly set by God. It's just amazing. So God continues to look out for him, and just I think this is what we kind of hope for, that this would symbolize this, just sort of transparency. And if you can't come to a place where you are open about your needs, and you can't be a community and open with each other, then we shrivel up and die. And you see that more and more in our society, especially in the West. And despite our advances in technology and everything getting easier in that way, it's getting worse and worse socially. I think it's getting harder and harder for us to tell each other we need each other and be there for each other. It's getting sort of more and more awkward to kind of knock on each other's door, because we have WhatsApp and we have, there's that whole kind of hierarchy of when it comes to communication. Like, I want to say something to someone, but there's that, wait, does this warrant a telephone call or just a text, or do I need to, or should I say this in person, or should I say, like, you have to go down that list, when in the past you're just like, go see the person. Like, you just, all you had was the one option of talking face to face to a person. And like, now you have all these layers of distance that you're able to put between you and a person that are meant to protect you somehow, or the other person, or whatever it is, but
or make your time more efficient.
Or make your time more efficient, yeah. Or whatever it is, but it's slowly killing us.
It also makes for terrible superficiality.
Yeah, terrible superficiality, right.
Just ridiculous things.
Right.
You can push light because you like
that. Right. 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 And of course, we're not Luddites, and it's not all evil, and there's lots of good has come from it, right? But we need to kind of know how to recreate this, and even what we're doing right now, obviously this is kind of superficial. Even this looks obviously not quite the real thing, right? But
but the idea is to stop, look around, think. Why am I doing what I'm doing? What's a relationship? Who am I with? Why, am I actually talking to this person, or is it just superficial? And so this is, I think, our heart. Chuck and Liz, from your lives, it's not just ministry or whatever. It's you as people and humans, as God's children. We want to thank you for all that you've done for so many of us, and even in all of your mistakes and weaknesses, which we all have, you've been humble enough to let God use them, and we thank you for that.
So we did like the 70s, and we went way over time. We ignored the clock.
I just want to end with this one verse as we close now. Remember that time Jesus went to the house of Levi and Matthew? Levi, Matthew, whatever his name was. Luke says Levi, Matthew says Matthew. And it says that he held a great banquet for Jesus. He pulled out his kitchen table, and a large crowd of tax collectors and others were eating there with him. But the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, who belonged to their sect, complained to his disciples, "Why do you eat and drink with tax collectors and sinners?" And Jesus answered them, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous to eat with me," I added that part, "but sinners to repentance." And so I just want to close here with this, the image of this table. You know, the table is this place, it's not just for good conversation, but it's about good relationship in the Lord. And I think this was Jesus' vision for the table, the Lord's table. Amen. Shabbat shalom.